Good evening. This is the Google versus China and everyone else panel. I'm Chris Huffines. I am an attorney, a trial attorney at a firm here in Atlanta called Casey Gilson. And my co-panelist is?
My name is Paul Toppins. I'm an attorney out of Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
And Paul and I are both from Texas, so you can assume that we are armed and angry. So I do this every time. I talk first, so I take charge.
Go ahead.
We're talking about Google versus China. Specifically, I think Google and China's little contretemps back in March of this year and then ongoing. I'm just going to assume that all of y'all know what happened. Is that a fair assumption, or do we need to be educated?
I came partially because I feel that I followed it on the news, but okay. I don't feel like I closed those. It felt sketchy anyway.
We have one honest man in the room. So we'll do a quick history, and then we'll dig into the details, I guess. Let me back up. China has the Great Firewall of China, which allows it to monitor both incoming and, I'm getting some reverb here, incoming messages and internet traffic, as well as specific user surfing, which they use to promote mental sanitation amongst their citizens. Google has allowed their search engine to run in China for a while now, subject to censorship. Google is unique, or was unique, in that they at least notified the user that it was being censored. After a series of what looks like a couple of actual hacks of Gmail for users who were human rights activists, as well as what looks like some social engineering hacks, so they actually tricks people out of passwords. Google threw a bit of a fit about China and redirected all searches to google.cn, which is the internal Chinese Google, to google.hk, which is their Hong Kong service, slightly different Chinese language set, outside the firewall, and was uncensored results. After that, and that's apparently where we still are now, as of today, that Google HK is still the is still the search engine, but it's still subject to the firewall. Keith.
Wasn't there some contention that the hacks came from a school that is in fact state sponsored, and that some of it may have been state sponsored attacks? I think part of the reason they stuck it outside the firewall was retaliation.
I think everyone understood that it was the Chinese government who arranged the hacking, whatever particular avenue it actually took.
And I think I read something dated late July that on the Register, or one of those computer sites, that Google had said, we're not going to censor it anymore. We're just going to let it go. Whether they sent it to HK, Google HK, or just Google CN, but they just said enough.
And the other, I think, two important points are, one, Google motto is don't be evil, and they're already taking a significant amount of heat for acceding to the censorship China was imposing. And of course, China is not the most free and loving regime on the planet, and certainly has some issues with Falun Gong and Tibet and freedom in general. But definitely Falun Gong and the Dalai Lama are their two pet peeves.
I haven't looked at it in the last few weeks, but I thought the last news was Google.cn was no longer redirecting directly to Hong Kong, but if you go to Google.cn, they have a separate link on their page that allows you to go to the Hong Kong unfiltered site.
I had forgotten that. You're right.
And so that was kind of the compromise they reached. I guess it was last month or so.
I was in that long line this morning. I have heat stroke, so we're just gonna roll with that.
A little background on search engines, or at least former search engines. You know, Yahoo had been pressured into giving the identity of it has nothing to do with search, but pressured into giving the identity of someone who had a Yahoo email account, who had posted something using the Yahoo account, and it ended up resulting. We got a 10-year sentence. I was a little unclear from what I've read whether the guy actually had served the sentence or was serving the sentence or had been suspended. But in any event, it was bad news for them. And Yahoo got a lot of criticism. This was, I don't want to say 8 or 9 years ago, but Google was, don't be evil, is sort of held up as, you know, they wouldn't do that kind of thing.
Can y'all hear that?
Yeah.
It's like Harlan Ellison. That was a weird joke. The other interesting thing is that Baidu, B-A-I-D-U, which is Google, which is Chinese Google, essentially, has a very large share of the market in China. They essentially occupy where Google occupies for the U.S., vis-a-vis Bing and Yahoo and all them. So here's my take on what happened. And you know, I'm this guy, I live in Atlanta, and I don't interact with Chinese people in the country very often. So take this with however big a grain of salt you want. I think that Google was trying to not be evil. Specifically, I think they were trying to help. They interpreted what was going on in China as, well, China is progressively liberalizing. You know, they're significantly more capitalistic now. They're significantly less repressive. So Google's going to get in there, ride that wave, and help China and the Chinese people to throw off oppression by letting them realize exactly how often they were being censored. And I think if you take Google as a progressive organization and as an agent, then that really makes sense for them to have gone in and say, I'm going to accept censorship because I'm pushing against it constantly. And then, you know, also it'd be really good business for Google, which is certainly something they need to do. And once they kind of got mugged, once China showed that, nah, screw you, we're still a government, you're still a corporation, they decided that it just wasn't worth the hassle and retreated to a more defensible position, which is the unfiltered search results. That's my two cents. Shoot me down, please, if you want.
Don't you somewhat, Google's in a no-win situation to some extent, because once you cross national boundaries, one society's definition of evil can be significantly different, in fact, completely opposite of another culture's. And so since they're a US-based corporation, they're being judged by the US sensibilities for what evil is, and yet the people in China might not necessarily think that what Google's doing or not doing is necessarily evil. And so whose opinion wins?
Mine and Paul's.
At least you're honest.
That's a really good point, I think, that Google did run into an interesting cultural difference. And because one of the comments I've read, the reason that communism has worked so much better, or socialism, in China is that culturally they're more predisposed to dealing with it than the Russian Soviet culture, which was essentially European. I'm not sure how much I agree with that, but it does make a certain amount of sense. I think also, though, that Google is applying the U.S. definition. By progressive, I mean progressive U.S. politics, and with all the cultural blind spots that implies.
So, and from our point of view, Google's doing a good thing because they're rebelling against the regime. From China's point of view, Google's evil because they're subversive and undermining their culture. So they can't win. They're evil there, or good here, or evil here and good there.
Yeah, and they had to make a choice of who they wanted to butter their bread, if you will. And they picked us.
It's not just that.
Are you going to address the connection to the NSA?
Paul?
Yeah, are you going to address the connection to the NSA? I'm curious about that one, too.
I was going to defer to my learned colleague here.
I'm unaware of the connection to the NSA. Why don't you?
Kind of inside information. I work in information security, and I kind of hear about these things. I won't say how. But the issue is that when this was happening, they said, oh my, we're being attacked. This is really bad. And so what they did is they kind of turned to the NSA for help because they're kind of experts in this stuff. Many people see that as essentially Google as being the quintessential modern version of the hippie culture, turning to the FBI for help. That was the antithesis of that culture. And so some people think that the fact that they turned to the NSA for help is a contradiction in terms in doing evil. So they were kind of cursed for that here, too.
Well, this wasn't a particularly smart thing to do in the first place. And whatever missteps they've made in the fallout, they're going to screw something up. The other interesting thing, and I'm kind of sideways addressing your point, is that Google's a corporation. You know, it has a fiduciary duty to its shareholders to make money, and the consensus is that, I'm going to say his name wrong, Sergey Brin, who owns like 30% of the voting stock, so he's got a lot of clout, woke up and said, wait a minute, I'm supporting a totalitarian state here, China. I grew up in a totalitarian state. I'm not very fond of them. And he put his foot down. And that was a big part of the decision to jump offshore to Hong Kong. So you're definitely getting this very interesting cultural of the founders and also of the culture they tend to have embraced, the hippie culture, you said. Versus this very corporate culture, which they're a huge company, they have a bunch of employees, they have obligations to their employees and shareholders. There definitely is a culture clash going on as far as how Google can act and will act.
It's not necessarily measured against American sensibilities or Chinese sensibilities of the government. The fact that these people are looking for a way to do this search unedited, uncensored, means that they feel it's evil. The people using the Google service are also saying to Google, hey, we need this, we want this, we need you to help us, this is evil.
Right. There we get that point. The very fact that the Chinese individuals who are not technically capable of circumventing the firewall are searching for things that the government says you shouldn't, proves that Google needs to provide the service.
The issue, a couple of issues, but first issue is, he said people that aren't technologically capable of circumventing the firewall. Obviously, most people, well, I would say a lot of people at Dragon Con know ways to get around firewalls and get around, you know, things like blocking IP addresses and so forth. You're familiar with the techniques that are used, and there are lots of them, just loads of them. But the average Joe doesn't necessarily know how to do that. And so to my mind, the issue is, how much do you make yourself available to the masses? There's an argument that Google being available, even in a limited form, even in a restricted form, is better for the people that are being restricted on the long run than if it's just gone away entirely. That's an argument. I don't know. Obviously, Google maybe come down the other side of that right now, but it certainly has some basis. I understand the arguments for it. I can understand the reasoning. The bigger issue to me is, we've got an international communication network now that we didn't have not that long ago, and we're going through a struggle of which local community gets to set the standards for the international system. And part of this session was Google versus China. And I think Italy was mentioned, at least in one of the things that I was sent. In Italy, three Google employees in the U.S., well, now all in the U.S., were held liable because somebody posted on Google Videos a video of an Italian setting, you know, Italian kid with Down syndrome being bullied by four other guys. The four other guys posted the video. It was up there for a while. Finally, when Google was notified, they brought it down, and the kids that helped track down the kids that had abused this kid. But they were held liable in absentia for violating Italy's privacy laws, basically. And of course, the real travesty to me, and I'm sure you would agree 100%, is that two of those three Google employees were their legal counsel. So, you know, if we have something that threatens the legal counsel in America with something that happens overseas, that's just outrageous. And
lawyers should be like gods in the courtroom.
but it is an issue. What privacy rules apply? Obviously, Google can apply separate rules if you're using the local domain, Google IT or whatever it is in Italy. But there are ways to circumvent that. If you just go google.com, you may not be redirected to the local one. You know, there are ways to get the and then what happens? Because that content's out there, and it comes into the country, and politicians are likely to say, wait a minute, you should not allow it in any fashion. You know, it shouldn't come into Italy. They don't seem to understand. Remember Ted Stevens' famous description of the internet as a series of tubes. You know, they don't understand that, and they don't really care to understand that. You know, so but the downside for the countries that are restrictive is they don't want to miss out on this steam engine this diesel engine that's running towards the future. That's the internet. If they start cutting themselves off, their citizens off from things that other people have access to, then it hurts them in the long run.
Jim on the back's been waiting a while.
Yeah, I have sort of a follow-up question both to that issue as well as the one about the NSA, and that is the role of the United States government in this process, because obviously, especially in the case of China, they have a number of vested interests in the way that this dispute turns out. On the one hand, they're going to be very interested in promoting the notion of freedom of expression and accessing these kinds of information without an awful lot of restrictions. But on the other hand, China is a significant trading partner and political rival, so they have a lot of interest in making sure that perhaps the friction between Google and China does not become too severe. What is the role of the United States government or the role that they are taking in this particular dispute, or are they just kind of saying, hands off and stand back and see what happens?
I'll jump into this. My personal conception of international law is very much state of nature. That's a very libertarian and conservative viewpoint. It's not a very liberal viewpoint. So that's where I'm coming from. The United States government arguably can let a corporation, it's a big boy, can play by itself. As a practical matter, we tend to be protectionists of our own corporations. And the fact that the NSA helped out when asked doesn't surprise me nearly as much as the fact that they got asked in the first place. That being said, the United States has also, and not just under George W. Bush, had a commitment to promoting democracy throughout the country, and China is not the most democratic country in the world. So I can definitely see the United States feeling that those two interests, protecting its own corporations and promoting its form of government, dovetail very nicely in this situation. Whether you think they ought to be doing it in the first place is more of a values question.
There's another aspect that has not been discussed on the net that I've seen yet. There's a national security implication based on a paper that was presented at Black Hat in 2008 of data mining on Google. You're able to determine, and Facebook and Twitter and everything else, you can find out who all the members of the Second Infantry are and who they're hanging out with. And then if you can get into Google, you can suddenly find out that everybody in this one unit is all finding out what the weather's like in Baghdad. Well, all of a sudden you've got now classified tactical information about movements of troops, equipment, resources. So I could see a vested interest from national security standpoint for the NSA getting involved also, because I could see this as a strategic attack.
Actually, they don't even need to worry about that, because now that Twitter has location, you know, all they just go to their Twitter page and see they're in Baghdad. You know,
yeah.
Everybody's doing location now.
Facebook?
Facebook does it, but I was thinking that Gmail off. Or Google Voice or somebody did it too. I mean,
Latitude.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
A stalker's
yeah.
best friend.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it goes back to the question about why Google went to China in the first place. The internet is a democratizing technology. It pushes power down to the people and away from institutions and governments. I mean, flash mobs. That's just not possible without the internet. Guy cries, Glenn Beck. You know, that thing that and the Tea Party, those are both extremely internet-dependent phenomena. And I really think that Google was thinking, we're going to go in there, we're going to slide some of this stuff in, they won't know what hit them, and next thing we know, democracy. And China's sitting there going, you know, we've been doing this repression thing for 50 years. We know what we're doing. And Google lost. I mean, that's honestly what I think happened. So,
yeah, I see a more base motivation too. China is a huge, huge market, and Google, although it's not evil, I think it didn't actually. You look at their mission statement. I think it's you don't have to be evil to make money is the full statement, and it's been shortened to don't be evil.
As a lawyer, I disagree with that.
Well, I won't touch that one. But I could see them saying, you know, they don't like that Baidu, or however you pronounce it, is number one in China. They want to be number one everywhere. And so I think that they, for a while, wanted to try to see if they had a chance, and if they could get in and get the advertising dollars that we know is coming next.
And one of the other things that I've read recently is that Google is kind of moving away from the search engine as its primary driver of its business, especially with brain work, Droid, with the phones. You know, China's an enormous market for new technology. So I think they might lose to Baidu. They wouldn't lose to Microsoft and to Apple in the phone market. That may have also been one of their motivations, is to capture a non-search engine market.
Could you spend a minute to clarify censorship in the sense that it can have a lot of varying degrees? So in China, maybe what are some things that they are censoring, and what are some things maybe from your expertise that we would think they are that they're not? Does that question sort of make sense to offer some clarity?
Their censoring is inconsistent from everything that I've read. Some sites will be blocked sometimes they won't. The New York Times was blocked for a while, and they took it away. Sometimes I've read that they're blocked in some places in China, but not in other places.
There's an enormous bureaucracy. That's the internet police. I think it was 30,000 members.
I read 50, but I mean, it's just huge. Of course, to China, that may be a drop in the bucket. Yeah. I don't know.
Slightly larger physically. But the sites they tend to censor are the usual suspects. You think of Falun Gong, which is a repressed religious movement, anything involving Tibet. I think anything that's critical of China as a government or as a people is also criticized. I don't know about some other topics like religion.
Tiananmen Square, anything that mentions Tiananmen Square.
Tank Man is a banned search engine, search term.
A lot of Taiwan sites I've read are blocked, but it varies. There also is, sex sites are blocked too.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
No. Something we didn't make clear earlier, and I'm changing the topic, is that Hong Kong and the city of Macau were both treaty ports for a long time, and Hong Kong got handed back in 97, 99, I forget.
Supposed to be 99, they got it early, I think.
Under treaty, though, it is not under the same legal system as the rest of China. So moving it to Hong Kong was essentially the same as moving it to the U.S. or moving it to Taiwan, as far as being inside China versus being outside China. And that's why Google.hk gets uncensored search results, which are then censored as it goes through the firewall into China.
That's true, but when I read that, it sort of surprised me. I mean, what if China, I don't see the teeth in that treaty. It really surprises me that they don't say, we're going to start doing things in Hong Kong a little bit differently.
Apparently they have violated the treaty a couple times at least.
Yeah, I think
but,
so.
But Hong Kong is such an economic powerhouse. I think they're not going to kill the golden goose.
Yeah.
When I listen to the discussion and look at the things that have been written, to me it seems to raise a somewhat larger issue about what level of responsibility you place on corporations, IPs, et cetera, and what responsibility they have. As an example, we're somewhat two-faced in a sense about that, because we would like for entities such as Google to conceal the identity of people that are posting things that are negative to China, for an example. At the same time, we within the country have permitted the system to force IPs to be responsible for, release the names of, and transactions of people who have downloaded music, and something as venal as that. And at the same time, we want them to go to the wall for bigger issues. To me, that seems somewhat two-faced. Either the IP is responsible for what's going on under its roof, or it's not. If it's not really responsible for what's going on under its roof, and the people that are doing it are responsible, then the IPs themselves aren't under threat. If you want to hold the IPs responsible, in the case of Google, to conceal someone's identity, then you can't threaten IPs with lawsuits in this country, otherwise you're somewhat two-faced. Who's really responsible for that? Where do we draw the line as to who's responsible for actions? Is it the corporation and the IP? Is it the person doing it? I sometimes think we don't have a good, clear idea of that in our own mind here within this country.
I'll give the quick, easy answer, which is we're all, you know, hypocrites in some form or fashion. And now you can give the nuanced response.
I was going to quote Mark Twain and say, consistency is the bugaboo of the small mind. And then say that I think you have a very valid point. I think that the United States and China would alternately say that their legal regime is in the hands of their enlightened employees, you know, judicial members, or the Chinese authorities, and that you know, their sovereignty in their respective physical zones should control. And if that means Google has to act two different ways, that's Google's problem. They chose to operate in two different jurisdictions. But you have a very valid point as far as the morality of it.
One thing I would kind of say to what you just brought up was there is an issue of power. And in the United States, the idea is that the power flows from the people. And the government takes from the people the powers that, and this sounds really stupid, and I'm probably going to yell that in about 2 seconds, the powers we can't trust individual people with. And then we collectivize that. But for the most part, we, individuals, drive the society. Chinese society is top-down. And it's come to that after so very long that the bureaucracy is amazing. It's a beautiful machine that I can't figure out.
You sound strangely and disturbingly admiring of that.
Yeah, disturbingly admiring. The thing, though, is that in the United States, with respect to the music issue and everything, from a perspective, the government was used as a hammer of individuals. The music industry owns, almost as individuals, if you think of the corporations as people, the rights to that. They appeal to the government to pursue individuals, and the government enables the people to have that power through its arbitration. It sounds kind of bizarre. I could probably write it out a little better if I had more time to think about it, but that's kind of where it comes from. In China, it's the government. There is only the government. The government is the corporation. The government runs everything and implies and enforces the rules and makes the laws almost irrespective of what the common person believes or wants. There are those enlightened individuals, like you say, who are chosen to be the government. And so, whereas in the United States, you know, you have some music up on there and you get prosecuted and stuff like that, it isn't actually the United States government that's prosecuting you. It's the RIAA. They have filed a lawsuit against you, gone through the government's courts, used the government as a hammer to pursue you. Whereas if it was China, it literally would be bureaucrats in the Chinese government in the region or province that you live prosecuting you, almost regardless of what I heard they put that in the dictionary. Anyway, regardless of what the individual owner has in pursuit of the harmonious society kind of way. That's my 2 cents. I got nothing else.
That was like a quarter at least.
Yeah,
sorry. One of the things that they taught me in law school was that the entire point of going to trial is that you to decide who gets to ask the government to drop the hammer on the other person. They didn't put it quite that cool, but.
A follow-up to that thing. Like in China, I'm from China, okay. So in China, the judicial system is so different than here. Like if you look up the China's code system, like mm-hmm. law system, you won't find any text about like government should have the right to censor. I mean, it's not on the book.
Right.
But yeah. They do it anyway. So it's so different like than here. Like you can find law to sue someone. Like you can use judicial system to do it. Like in China, like the government officers were just like, they think you're not doing the right thing. So like they will use a court or judicial system to against you to do things. So it's different. And the second comment I want to make is how the Great Firewall works. So for Chinese people, our daily internet use does not quite involve Great Firewall that a lot because you don't use a lot of cross border traffic unless you. The daily thing in China is actually like whenever you view something, like based on a Chinese website or you're a website owner in China, like you have to surrender your, if you're a website owner, you have to like surrender your cell phone number, and you have to ensure it's 24 hour on. So like whenever they find harmful information on your website, they will call you and ask you to delete it. If you don't do it, like they will have police to come to you. And they know which server you're on. So like if you don't do it in like 48 hours, they will unplug the Ethernet cable. So like your website will go offline. So that's what they do in China. Like the Great Firewall, although it has a lot of international attentions to it, it doesn't really, it's not really the most important part in the China's censor system. Like what they do to Google is they let Google to set up a guy called a government relationship officer, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like they call him all the time and say, hey, we find harmful information, please delete it. So like, I don't, it's not scalable, yeah.
Google had I don't know exactly technically how they were doing it, but I think they had a system that was randomly, instead of spidering out across the firewall, they would just check, and if it got blocked by the firewall, they just blacklist the site. So they were kind of freeing themselves from some of that work. But those are both very good points. I would point out though that in other countries, France just brings to mind, that it's not a shot at France yet. The investigating officer, the prosecutor, is also your judge. So just because we have our system doesn't mean that it's necessarily the best one. But those are both good points.
But you know, there's a theory. I've read it at least P.J. O'Rourke, but he's not original with him, that in order for a society, an economy especially, to progress and to function well and to thrive, there has to be the rule of law. And the rule of law means that anybody can determine what the rules are. They're not set by some arbitrary caprice or whim of somebody else. And on the whole, on a macro level, not, you know, there are obviously instances where, you know, in this country you'll get a, you know, bad judge that'll make decisions that you know just don't comply with the law at all. But that idea sort of appealed to me, at least the simplicity of it, because even though countries do get along and they do thrive, and China certainly is thriving, the premise is that they reach a point where the people who are making all the money there begin to demand the rule of law because they need it in order for their businesses. You know, a lot of the pressure that's taking place in China has to do with you know, things like the school that exploded because of, you know, the fireworks that the kids were making, or the
or the ones that collapsed in that earthquake.
About things collapsing and all the people being killed. And that information got out there. And you know, much as they wanted to clamp down on it, you know, it's hard with the technology today for the guys in control to keep the lid on it. And I think, you know, the way I look at it, the progression is hopeful that will continue, and that it'll be harder and harder, and they'll just have to give up and just say, well, you know, this is just part of the way the world is.
And going back to the fellow from China's point, we have a presumption, because we're so technology heavy, that everybody's trying to look at our stuff. There's 300 million people here in the U.S., and granted, English is an international trade language, and a lot of websites, even in other countries, are in English and their native language. But there's 1.3 billion, that's like four times the number of people here in the U.S., in China. Who says they want to look at our stuff? They got their own stuff to look at.
And China is still very rural. I mean, it's also extremely industrial, but it's not everybody wants to go and move to the U.S. A bunch of them want to go and just keep working the farm or keep staying in their same village. So it's not, and that's not a shot. That's just a fact that it's a very rural economy. It's also a very graying economy.
Yeah. How many of us spend most of our time on foreign websites?
Not Farmville.
What do you think? I mean, I realize this is a Google versus China conference, but what do you think about the role of the individual in all of this in terms of, you know, I think the Tor network isn't applicable in that case, but I remember when the storm around the Great Firewall was happening a few years ago that there were some people who put forth some technologies to allow individuals to, you know, to host and allow, in theory, allow breaches in the firewall. Is there anything currently going on in that field that that you think individuals should be attentive to as far as not putting it all on Google and just accepting that we can all contribute in some part?
There is a, well, yes, there are. There is a thing I read that was sort of interesting where someone had come up with a little piece of software add-on, I guess, to a browser, I think that's what it was, that made it use of the HTTPS settings because they figured nobody can no country can successfully block HTTPS settings because they're so they use on so many different sites. You know, they use for banking sites and everything else. And so they had something that you could use that and it would allow you to, you know, bypass the firewall and connect to a server elsewhere and then do your searching. I thought that was a nice little technique. I can't remember what it was called or anything.
There's something else, and I don't remember if it's Tor or not, and I apologize, that allows you to set up your own home computer as a, basically to bounce from banned sites. I think it is Tor, but I don't remember. And that's a technological fix that, but you know, the Chinese people have to also know how to use it, trust it. I mean, they don't know if it's from the government or not. All they know is, well, somebody's talking about this. They haven't been arrested yet. You know, a totalitarian government rules by fear in a lot of respects. And until they're technically savvy enough to be able to prove to themselves or to their very small circle of friends that this is legit, there's going to be some problems from our end.
Look at the RIM and BlackBerry in the Arab countries right now. They're very upset because the server that does this cute link between the phones and the to the phones is located out of the country, and they were sort of going to start shutting down BlackBerry service. One of them, and I can't remember if it was United Arab Emirates or whatever, but they sent out a little software patch. Yemen did it. But anyway, they sent out a looked like an authorized software update, but all it did was load in, so all the SMS messages were sent to, you know, the government servers, and RIM came out and said, no, that's not authorized. We have a patch to pull it off. But the thing is, they got in, got in the middle and sent that out, and you didn't know better. You didn't know. You trusted that it was coming from BlackBerry. I read something in preparing for this about DNS poisoning, which I'd never heard of, where everybody knows all the internet addresses basically are numbers, and the names they apply to them is like go to a giant phone directory, and you know, you put on, you know, dragoncon.com, and it goes in and finds the right number sequence to go to. And so there are all these DNS servers, the digital naming sequence or whatever that stands for, around the country that have those phone books, and they're, you know, they keep them cached locally and whatever. But anyway, DNS poisoning is basically getting in there, messing up the records so that instead of pointing the right place, it points someplace else, and can be done with depending on how you are careful the DNS server you're using. But if the DNS servers are all in China and they can get a hold of some of them, you know, some of the internet service providers, and they can just substitute addresses, you think you're going to some place that's safe, but lo and behold, it's not.
And China is one of those governments that's not very happy with the fact that the U.S. pretty much runs that master phone book. And it's because we're not going to screw around with it, but they would like to, or at least have the threat of being able to. So, who was the phone?
I know that during the Iranian elections with the green protests, there was a guy who set up... I haven't looked in the technology, and I totally just forgot what it was called, but it's a steganographic sort of system where you can actually go and you can embed other websites' entire content inside of an image, and it'll pretend, it uses some sort of merging. I haven't looked into it, like I said, like I saw the article on Wired, that's really all I read. But it somehow merges the content of that into the images coming off of Iranian pre-approved news sites, so that people in Iran are able to communicate or see the New York Times, for example, embedded in an image. And it's a really easy to use technology. He's been working, I think he actually worked with the State Department to develop it because, I mean, it's Iran, we don't like them, sorry. But yeah.
And that goes back to the gentleman's point about the extent to which the US government is not playing their own backyard. by helping these companies out. I had not heard of that yet.
Yeah, if those anybody interested in that, just go in and look for steganography Flickr. And yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff about that right now. You know, you talked about, can you trust that you're seeing what you think you're seeing? This morning we had a session on WikiLeaks, and somebody brought up the, of course, issue of, well, maybe WikiLeaks is really run by the CIA, and all the leaks are actually on purpose to give out false information, and then they can track where the false information shows up, and they know where the bad guys are. Well, if you can have that kind of conspiracy theory about people that are out in a free society, how much more suspicion is there of somebody in China that the government's really back there messing with them?
Yeah. With the NSA's help and the other help he was just speaking of and all, it easily could be made to look like to the Chinese people, just like what you said, where was a school, you said, a lot of those attacks on Google came from?
That was what Keith said, actually.
You know, yeah. The Chinese government coming down through the school would look the same way. You know, it's the NSA coming in using Google to go after China. And it makes it look like it's really the American government driving the thing.
And the American government is a favorite. Hugo Chavez. According to him, we've been about to invade Venezuela for about 10 years. And, I mean, we don't care. We being American, but if it's a very convenient threat to hang over somebody's head, that, you know, don't do this or the U.S. will come invade.
There was a Russian politician said they had a weather control machine.
Don't talk about the weather control machine.
I was like, if we had a weather control machine, I think we'd run this world. Like, it would just be over.
There's a joke about Earl in there I'm not going to make.
A little bit more about the school in China. It's a school that teaches technology and how to hack, and a lot of the government cyber warriors are trained at this school, and students there, some of the classes they take, you fail the class if you're not successful breaking into a U.S. computer. So that's some inside information about, and that's from somebody who was involved in the investigations.
Since you mentioned
they're very good.
The weather machine. This has nothing to do with Google, but it seems appropriate. Seems appropriate for Dragon Con. I've been waiting, and all the talk about climate change or global warming, for somebody to connect it with Carl Sagan, who used to talk about nuclear winter, and you know, if we explode enough bombs, we'll create enough cloud cover that it'll lower the temperature. And what I'm waiting for, and this, you know, you guys that have a science fiction bent, is for somebody to do something about the country that is affected most, say, assuming their global warming predictions come true, or climate change predictions, and it has the consequences like the drought in Russia. And some of them, somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, some country, and says, we need to lower the world's temperature by a degree or two. We're just going to set off some bombs. And that'll help us out because, you know, we're in really bad shape right now. I think that'd be an interesting scenario. So y'all run with that. I'm looking forward to hearing next year at Dragon Con.
Actually, a more plausible, deniable tactic would be to use a nuke to cause Krakatoa to go off again, which is apparently building. I just read an article the other day.
Like Krakatoa? No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking something.
Krakatoa, I think, blew up in 1883 and caused a worldwide drop in temperature.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of that as the asteroid in Russia.
No, there are some corporations who are looking into seeding different compounds into the atmosphere to combat the greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm. China does use artillery around, or did at least for the Olympics around Beijing, to shoot some crystal that was supposed to cause it to rain to knock the smog out of the air.
But and proposing this as an alternative to all the, you know, cap and trade and all the different.
It's a cornucopiist view. If you're familiar with cornucopia, it's a cornucopiist view of that. Cornucopia, and I'll mangle it, but it's an economic theory that things tend to work out when there's enough financial incentive for them to work out. And so you don't have the population bomb that Paul Ehrlich predicted. You know, things, you know, the grain harvests have increased tremendously because of all the things that we've done scientifically. Anyway, the cornucopia's view, I think, would be when the climate change gets to a level where it begins to really start affecting things seriously, when we start having tornadoes every month, and, you know, and, or every week in this part of the world, that there'll be a financial incentive to do something about it. And it'll be something like shooting off those things or setting off bombs or who knows
what. Orion Drive.
A what?
Thrust using nuclear bombs out the back.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
But I think we're off topic. So next.
I guess I'll push us back on topic a little bit. Now, with respect to all the technologies that allow the Chinese people to circumvent the firewall, you still have to get outside the country. I mean, you know, if you're touching a server inside of China, that server's still got to ship the traffic out of China somehow, and China presumably owns all of the nodes in China, so they're able to track the data flow across the network, and they're able to understand who and when. At least from a corporate level, who is actually transferring data across the firewall,
right?
And they can stop that.
And the 30,000 or 50,000 people they have, I mean, they actually monitor your internet use in a lot of respects.
Or they give you the impression that a lot of it is you think they're monitoring. It's 1984 Big Brother. You think that you might be watched, and so you behave differently.
Going to the Italy case, since
that's right,
there's a rather interesting sort of governmental and civil liability here. What are the issues surrounding individual freedom and liability with respect to governments pursuing other individuals internationally? Let's say I was a total jerk and I posted on 4chan from like Russia that, you know, I hate Americans, they're all a bunch of buttheads. Oh, and I libel somebody. You know, yeah, I know, right? Yeah, that's why it was great. Just use that example, and then, you know, so that's a civil liability. Like I libel some company, or I just go out and cause trouble. And then there's the governmental liability of like, I live in, who knows, Sao Paulo, and for some reason I'm like, I'm gonna bomb an American city, haha. You know, then the American government's gonna come after me. I mean, what are the sort of emerging standards there?
This is a kind of a muddled area right now, and Paul's laughing at me now.
Yeah, don't do it. But I my advice.
Yeah. This is a little 30,000 foot level. Individual countries are sovereigns. They control their space. You know, United States, Florida to Alaska, and you know, this is mine. I run what happens here. England, I'm England. I run what happens here. Some countries, Portugal or Spain, being a good example, have what they feel is called universal jurisdiction, which is you did something bad somewhere else. If it is bad enough, I have jurisdiction over you because I'm a citizen of the world. That's how, I think it was Pinochet, mm-hmm. got extradited for something he did not in Spain, but in Chile, Peru? Mm-hmm. Chile. And a lot of people in the United States is a big one of these people says that that's completely nuts. The formal system that exists is the extradition system, and before this, at least in the common law countries, which is the English American system, before the court can exercise power over you, it has to have jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction is what we call it, which is you have in some way touched the court's area that the court can reach out and touch you back. And so service of process, you know, where you actually get served, I'll be quiet, is...
In the U.S., it's called minimum contact.
Yeah.
So that's the...
And there's various ways to do it. What's called a long-arm statute, that's where a court says, you're not in the jurisdiction anymore, I'm going to get you anyways. Universal jurisdiction is an extreme expansion of that idea of personal jurisdiction. So what should happen under the old system is you're tried in absentia maybe in England. England's got very liberal libel laws. And then the English plaintiff who wins takes that judgment and goes to Russia and says, please, sir, I have a judgment. Will you enforce it for me? And Russia probably says, nit. They might say yes, you never know. But then what they do is they domesticate that judgment and turn it into a Russian judgment and then enforce the Russian judgment. but it's really complicated, as you can tell just from the explanation. And it's changing. And I think that in the, at least in the Italian case, they use the fact that this happened to an Italian citizen as the hook for personal jurisdiction, even though it's really a strange thing for somebody who may not have even ever been in Italy. But yeah, the international nature of the internet makes jurisdiction questions very odd.
The people who were involved in the Italy case, were they actually working in Italy at the time it happened, or were they working here?
One of them had an Italian connection. He was the an Italian board member of Google's board, I guess. The other two were the Global Privacy Council, and the other one was the Senior Vice President and Chief Legal Officer of Google, I guess out in California.
A great example, not in the Google context, is the Bhopal incident. Union Carbide Inc.'s employees do not go to India because they will be arrested for murder, whereas Union Carbide India's employees, who are all Indian, by the way, by and large, have served 5-year jail terms and they're done. And it's a very interesting jurisdictional question, but that was one of the first big, pardon the phrase, blow-ups of that.
Of course, it took 25 years or longer for them to finally reach some judgment in something in that
Bhopal's
case.
I mean, just a screwed up situation.
Hard.
You mentioned earlier running your own Tor node so that dissidents in other countries can get out, you know, and trying to help the little guy in the other country. That can have unintended consequences you haven't thought of. An actual case that happened, in fact, I've got the facts in my desk drawer and I show it to the information security class.
We've thought of them all. We just didn't say them.
What happened was there was a Columbine incident in Germany where somebody sent an email to the German police, said, I'm going to go blow up that school and shoot people. And then they followed through with their threat. On the anniversary of that, they sent via Tor, the Tor network, an email to the German police saying, we're going to do it again. They took it very, very seriously. So they immediately turned around to the person who was operating the Tor exit node that the email came from and said, ooh, that's the mail server it came from. That was one of my servers. It's part of a sponsored research project. Unfortunately, the two researchers on the project were on an island at a conference where there was no cell phone contact. So we were freaking out, calling the hotel, trying to find these guys, because they called our State Department, the Germans did, who called the FBI, who sent our information security chief for the campus an email, or the fax, who then faxed it over to me and said, they want the logs off this server. Well, those who've ever operated a Tor server, there are no logs, it boots from a CD. And now we're trying to explain to translators, the FBI, the State Department, to some German policeman, I really don't have any logs, I'm not obstructing justice, I will gladly ship you the server if it'd help, but I'm trying to find the researcher, could you hold on a minute? And they're saying, no, they're gonna blow up our school again. So you could actually, without intending to do it, end up in the middle of something like this by trying to help some dissidents in China.
The interesting thing is to remember in the legal arena is, I read this recently, the law, the area of being a lawyer, is one of the basic ways that the liberal arts street you can make lots of money straight out of school. So most lawyers are not engineers and are not programmers and do not understand this. I'm pretty ignorant about technical stuff. I'm totally honest with y'all. I am the smartest technical person in my law office. And they call me and they say, this is not working. And I say, okay, I'll fiddle with it for 5 minutes and then we'll call IT. and that's just, I mean, lawyers specialize not in technology because we have this whole other thing to do. But, you know, treaties and laws and the FBI or the German, whatever the German version of FBI is, they're not technical people. They are pardon the phrase, normal people who are interacting with technology frequently.
No offense.
We're
getting the microphone up. My concern, if I ever set up one of those servers, is not about the violent threats so much as it is, somebody runs child pornography or something through it, and then, you know, you get branded, you know, as a sex criminal for the rest of your life and have to live, you know, under the freeway bypass, which that's the thing that deters me from setting up one.
You hope that the local police would eventually figure that out and exonerate you?
No, I don't hope that at all. I don't
really
think...
It's hard to unring that bell.
Yeah.
All right, sorry.
To I just have a thought on censorship and information freedom that I need to share with the group, just kind of related. In this country, we have much less censorship than China. We have a lot of information out there. You have access to so much information that you can, in fact, pick and choose what you want to see. And a lot of people, there's a lot of talk about politics getting extremely polarized in this country, and I think part of the underlying cause there is that a lot of people are spending their whole time only choosing to read sources of information that they already agree with, and they're living in this echo chamber and continuing, even though they have a whole world of information out there, we have a tendency to pick and select only what we want to see. And as a result, we're making ourselves more extreme, and in fact, through censorship, that's China's way to cut down on extremism. They're trying to prevent people from seeing things, whereas in our society, I would like to encourage everyone and remind everyone, read a variety of news sites, read a variety of sites, read things you don't necessarily agree with, just so that you don't spend your whole life living in an echo chamber, because then, in a way, you are just like those Chinese citizens that are seeing a very limited view of the world, and you, so long that you believe that that's the way it is, if you, say, only watch Fox News, for example, or even only watch Rachel Maddow all the time if you're on the other side of the aisle, too. Just
you make
we have the information. We have much less censorship. Use it.
And there's a study that if you have a particular political viewpoint and you are reading someone who has also a viewpoint, of course they're smart. Of course they're right. If it's somebody with whom you disagree, of course they're wrong. Of course they're acting in bad faith. And it's psychologically we're wired to agree with people who agree with us, and keeping that open is a very good thing to do.
I might just sort of argue the point that echo chambers in discourse have always existed, and human communities are always insular and sort of just basically blocks of 150 people that you can stand to be around. And essentially, so echo chambers just happen because...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The other 149 people in the room all agree. but we are getting off topic again, it seems.
I disagree. Get out!
Burn him!
Any other questions out there?
Think you killed the discussion.
What's the role of the International Court in all of this? Have fun with that one.
Next question. That's a good question. I don't know if China is a signatory to the ICC. Yeah. No, we're not. Yeah, because George W. Bush, I think correctly, figured that about the first thing that would happen after we signed it was General, whichever one at the time was in charge, would be hauled up on charges, and didn't want to do that.
Spain has warrants out, I think, for Cheney and Scooter Libby and some other folks.
Yeah. I know they have Rumsfeld. Yeah. Whether you agree with that or not is not a point.
My wife is from Vietnam.
Okay.
And a lot of these censorship things that we're talking about happening in China are happening in Vietnam too, like 5-hour video gaming limits per day and having a Vietnam specific Google search engine. Is that happening in smaller countries like Vietnam because Vietnam is voluntarily seeing what China is doing and admiring it and trying to copy it, or is China somehow pressuring these other smaller Asian countries to do this kind of thing because they want to assimilate them someday?
I doubt they're pressuring them. I think that every country, every government in the world, if they could control things, secretly in their heart of hearts would like to do it. I think that's... Yeah, yeah. If this country didn't have its traditions and First Amendment and other things prohibiting it, I think they would want to clamp down on some sites. Yeah, I think Vietnam's motivations probably are just natural government control.
I think the government here is working on that as hard as they can. It's just the current situation, the population that's not.
I'm hoping technology will win out over our base.
I'm gonna disagree a little bit. Not with that one. With the previous comment, which is that I do think there's some element of Vietnam is undoubtedly more in China's sphere of influence than ours, and or any other European countries. And so when they look for a solution, they'll look at China first and see if it's working. And if it's not, then they'll look everywhere else. I could be wrong. You never know.
To some extent, can it just be market forces? I mean, they are a country and a different language.
To some extent, can't, as far as Baidu being primarily in China, mm-hmm. a Vietnamese search engine becoming predominant in Vietnam isn't surprising from a language cultural market standpoint, I wouldn't think.
It's a little weird that if China keeps winning but Japan doesn't, because there would be about the same amount of commonality, I think, because I think Vietnam and Japan both use the Chinese language characters. So it's the same amount of difficulty transferring over. English versus Chinese for Vietnamese business, that's not that surprising, you're right, just because of the difference in the language and the structure. Okay, we're actually going to go only a little bit over time. If that's the last question, going, gone. Thank you all for coming and for a good time.
Appreciate it.